that people can hear. Okay, thank you. I see God, it is not going away. You can also remove got it so that I can start.
Honorable Chair, good morning. I'm load shedded. Can I not open my video, please?
Okay, IT. Honorable Mananiso, can you hear us?
Yes, Chairperson, I am.
Thank you. Okay, so we are connected. It's only what we see there. Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome back, all of you colleagues, after a brief break. Let me welcome all of you members on the virtual platform from this day, the 14th of April. Welcome the invited evidence leaders to this committee, Advocate Bauer and Mayosi. Welcome all of you members of the media, our entire support staff in your various duties. Members of the public who probably would have had time in the break to go through the documents. I'm sure you yourself would have started analyzing the work that we do. I want to welcome you in your different platforms, 48 and YouTube. We're resuming our meeting. Just to indicate, I think for today we're continuing where we left as the committee meeting, and perhaps later on when we adjourn, we'll indicate how far we are to the inquiry, to the resumption of the inquiry. And so I don't want to waste time now to go there. I'm going to ask Advocate Bauer perhaps to just remind us and recap us and tell us where we are now in the unpacking of the evidence that have been placed in front of us over those 6 days, because that's what we want to conclude and complete in the remaining time before the resumption of the inquiry. Advocate Bauer.
Chair, good morning to the members and the public. Chair, I took the committee largely, or we took the committee largely through a substantial part of the record in the CR17 Busasa matter. I then took the committee, we dealt with the issue of the references in the affidavits insofar as it related to the IGI report, and I indicated that I would come back to the issue of the judgment as there was something missing in what I needed to check. But for today's purpose, I will come back to that at some point. For today's purposes, I'm going to look at what is contained in the judgment with reference to the reports which are referred to in the PP SARS unit report. We'll call it the SARS unit or the Gordhan report. And we do so with reference to the affidavits that was filed with the PP prior to the litigation, what was filed and served at court, and what was said in the judgment about it, so that one understands the judgment in the context of that. What I don't look at for this purpose is the argument that prevailed in before the court, but I will take you to essentially the legal argument in respect of, in particular, intelligence services in the judgment to get an understanding of that in the context of the affidavits. And I do so not because I am buying into this notion that the judgment isn't binding. The judgments are binding. And that under, and I say this as a preface so that you can understand where I'm coming from. But this is to give the committee an understanding of the affidavit evidence which is serving before the committee in the context of the judgment. So as a starting point, there must be an understanding, and I'm not making a closing argument. I just want to put the affidavits into context, that the High Court had ruled that the existence of the unit was lawful, and that finding stands. So to the issue of whether Minister Kurdane played a role in establishing the unit is of little moment in the light of the finding by the High Court that that was lawful. I'm simply doing a trolling through the evidence to give you an understanding of that. And so when I start with that, I'm going to start with saying is that what the judgment finds in paragraph 88, and I'm just going to read it, we don't need to go there for the moment, is that in determining whether the public protector's findings were rational, it was therefore important to ascertain what process she followed in coming to the findings and what evidence was available to her when she made her findings. The reports on evidence has been discussed in the judgment. And that's important because it's a particular point in time that the court looks at what is before it and what was put before, saying this was before the public protector. And she obviously on affidavit tells the court her version of it, and we will deal with that, right? So if we turn to the first thing, which will deal with the Sikakani report and Nugent Commission report, and I'm also going to preface by saying this, in some cases, there are quotes taken from the report that are repeated in the affidavit. So to not repeat quotes to the committee, I will simply indicate those as we go along and not read those out to you. And I want to start with and Shepo, you must open up bundle E, right? The committee can follow as we go along. So don't open up, go to bundle E, and it will be the first one of the record. Be bundle volume 10. Bundle E number 7, and it will be volume 4, number 4. And I'm going to try where I can to give you the PDF number so that you can find it easily. All right? Maybe we can do that for the most part. I've tried to do that. So if you go to PDF 387. So before the report is issued, Mr. Pillay provides the public protector with two affidavits. And this is the first of those two affidavits that we're going to go through. Maybe just go to the top of it so that the committee can see which affidavit we're in. Right to the top, just so that we go down. So there's a complaint, and Mr. Pillay makes this complaint to do that. And I'm not going to read the entire thing to you, but if we start and you can follow as I take you through it, just hold on a second, and we start at paragraph 6. At the time this affidavit is made, and he tells you this later in the affidavit, he had already left the employ of SARS in May 2015. And although there's a subpoena asking him to provide records, information, etc., he's not in possession of this. And he says that later in the affidavit. All right. But if we start with paragraph 6, right, he identifies that that there are 12 allegations which are wide-ranging, and it's clear that notwithstanding the vagueness with which the allegations are cast, not only do they cover a lengthy period of time, but also they refer to events that in the main occurred between 10 and 20 years ago. Right? He then says in paragraph 7 that he was effectively provided with 6 business days between the 10th of April and the 23rd of April to respond thereto. And then he goes in paragraph 8. He complains of a lack of a fair administrative process, and in particular, the inadequacy of it, because in this matter, there seem to have been allegations by Mr. Shavambo, but there's also an anonymous complaint which is not revealed. And in paragraph 8.3, he specifically states that paragraph 3 of the subpoena threatens me with criminal sanction should I fail to comply with the demands made in the subpoena. And paragraph 4 says, he says, I shall deal later in this affidavit with the fact that a number of the allegations now made were previously considered by the public protector almost 5 years ago. And then if we move on, let's go to paragraph 13. All right. He makes the point that he's not in the employ of SARS and he doesn't have access to records, information and witnesses. And then he says in paragraph 14 that under chapter 6 of the Tax Administration Act, he has limitations in respect of the disclosure of confidential information in relation to SARS to any party not in the employ of SARS. He then goes on. He points out that his attorneys had requested the cooperation in paragraph 14. That his attorneys had requested the cooperation of SARS in providing documentation to assist him to respond to the subpoena following a meeting with SARS officials, but that they had declined to provide the information, indicating that they pertain to personal information of third parties and internal operations of SARS. So at the time he answers this, he doesn't have documentation since that would be in the possession of SARS. He further makes the point in paragraph 16, that at this stage he has been charged with the commission of certain alleged offences, which charges remain pending against him. And although they are unfounded and vexatious, they hang over his head, and he does not waive effectively his rights under Section 35 of the Constitution to do that. So he stands by those rights, and it's against that background that he answers the affidavit. In paragraph 19-22, he points out that effectively that in August 2014, when he was acting commissioner of SARS, the public protector addressed correspondence to SARS in which he stated, and this is Advocate Madensala, in which he stated that a complaint had been made to our office that SARS had established an allegedly surreptitious investigative unit known as the National Research Group to conduct clandestine specialized investigations against unsuspecting civilians, politicians, and prominent businessmen for possible tax evasion. The public protector informed SARS that she had elected not to investigate these allegations and set out her reasons for making that decision. So effectively, there had been a decision by the public protector not to investigate. Further, that inasmuch as such allegations suggested unlawful or illegal activity on the part of SARS or its officials, this was and remains denied by me. Further, he says that the public protector went on to inform SARS that the investigation would, in the circumstances, be limited to issues relating to allegations concerning irregular recruitment processes in the appointment of the National Research Group officials and 2 other issues which are presently irrelevant. The public protector sought pertinent details and responses from SARS regarding the alleged irregularities in the appointment of the National Research Group employees, and SARS, when Pillay was still the acting commissioner, delivered a detailed response, including supporting documents to the public protector, which dealt with those requests. So then, if you go to the, I'm not going to go into further details on this affidavit. He then deals with certain answers. He then There's then a subpoena issued against him. And he, it starts at page 216, PDF 383. Go to that. All right. And he then files an affidavit in respect of this subpoena. Right. And I'm going to deal with the averments in the affidavit that deal with essentially the Sikakani panel report and the other reports. So go to page, go to paragraph 31.7 of this affidavit. That's not a... Yep. Here we go. And he says, the Sikakani panel report is fatally flawed in fact and law. I then points out the documentation in which it was as such recorded in. He says, first he starts with his, my submissions to the Sikakani panel in August and September 2014. My submissions in December 2014, which I prepared after the Sikakani panel had been delivered, which I addressed to the then SARS commissioner, Mr. Tom Weyane. A legal opinion obtained by SARS in January 2007. Legal opinion obtained by the then National Intelligence Agency in 2007. A legal opinion obtained by SARS in May 2007. Legal opinion obtained by the then SARS Commissioner, Mr. Moyani, in September 2015. A legal opinion obtained by Mr. Pravin Gordhan in March 2016. Then he says, testimony deposed to under oath by retired Judge Frank Cruen, who had chaired the SARS advisory board before the Commission of Inquiry into Tax Administration and Governance, that's the Nugent Commission, in September 2018. In this regard, I drew attention to the main report of the Commission delivered in December 2018, where the following was recorded by Judge Nugent in regard to that testimony. The SARS advisory report chaired by Judge Cruen, quoting it, reported to the minister and issued a media statement saying the unit was unlawful, but the evidence he told the commission that was not a conclusion reached independently by the board, but had been adopted from the Sikakani panel, and he had come to realize it was wrong. Indeed, he supported the re-establishment of capacity to investigate the illicit trades, which we recommended. And then the final report of the commission, where the following was stated by Judge Nugent. Why such a unit was considered unlawful is not clear to me. While the National Strategic Intelligence Act prohibits the covert gathering of certain intelligence that applies to intelligence concerning threats to the safety of the state. So Judge Nugent says, the Act prohibits the covert gathering of certain intelligence that applies to intelligence concerning threats to the safety of the state, which hardly applies to intelligence relevant to collecting tax. The members of the unit might at times have acted unlawfully, that SARS employment policies might have been breached, that members might unlawfully have acquired and used equipment, all of which came later to be alleged. I see no reason why SARS was and is not entitled to establish and operate a unit to gather intelligence on the illicit trades, even covertly within limits. Indeed, that was the view expressed to SARS in late 2015, which seems not to have been made public by SARS. An opinion was furnished to the former Commission of SARS on or about 1 September 2015 in response to the findings of the panel chaired by Advocate Sikakani, by Advocate Trengove, and Advocate Nkumalo. And it was said to be unlawful by a panel chaired by Advocate Sikakani, but I find nothing in its report to persuade me that it was so. Advocate Sikakani was asked if he could elaborate, but his reply took it no further than what was said in the report. And so I want to digress for a moment to take you to the Nugent report in a little bit more detail so that there's some understanding of what the Nugent report was about and what it said. And if we go to bundle E, 7, item 4 to PD. If it could be in the same document, go to 706. Yeah. Right. There are two reports by Judge Nugent. One is the interim report dated 27 September, and then a final report that he comes out with at 11 December 2018. And the gist of the first report was an advice effectively saying you need to appoint a new commissioner of SARS. But in the course of that, he deals with this issue in a few paragraphs from 35 onwards, right? And I'm going to come to the status of this commission before we deal with the final report, but let me just deal with what's in the interim report first. In paragraph 35, he says, an account of what brought SARS to its present condition must start with the extraordinary consequences of reports in the Sunday Times that an unlawful rogue unit existed within SARS. The unit concerned was a unit that had come into existence in about 2008 under the name Special Operations to investigate the illicit trade in tobacco, liquor, counterfeit goods, and so on. It later changed its name to the National Research Group and again metamorphosed into the High Risk Intelligence Unit, which comprised 6 members. Go on. Going to paragraph 40. I have not yet found why the creation and existence of the unit was said to have been unlawful, which is how it was consistently and uncritically depicted. I find no reason why the establishment and existence of the unit was indeed unlawful, and I'm supported in that by an opinion given to Mr. Muyani by leading senior counsel in late 2015. As far as I'm aware, that opinion has never been publicly disclosed. It might be that some of the activities of one or more of the 6 members was unlawful, but that is something else. If that was indeed the case, it is nonetheless incredible that unlawful acts of one or more of 6 men led to millions of rands being spent and the holding of repeated inquiries with continuing damage to the reputation of SARS. What sparked this off was a report in the Sunday Times on 12 October 2014. Some 2 weeks after Mr. Muyani took office on 27 September 2014. It was reported that an unlawful rogue unit existed within SARS whose members had planted listening devices in the home of former President Zuma. That report and others that follow in similar vein was to do immeasurable damage to SARS and to the lives of many people. Mr. Adrian Lekay, who was then the spokesperson for SARS, had got wind of the allegation shortly before the report was published through questions that were being posed to him by journalists, and he urged Mr. Muyani to take steps to deal with the allegations. But Mr. Muyani ignored him, contending that the allegations would come to naught, in stark contrast to his conduct when the allegations were published. Once having read the report in the Sunday Times on 12 October 2014, Mr. Muyani called together the members of EXCO that afternoon and demanded to know what they knew about the allegations, and all the members disavowed any knowledge. On Monday, the members of EXCO were summoned once again on this occasion with their subordinates and were asked once again what they knew. And the members of EXCO once again disavowed any knowledge, whereupon Mr. Muyani promptly announced he had no confidence in the members of EXCO and that it was disbanded. That response is extraordinary in any rational terms. Mr. Muyani had barely arrived at SARS with no experience of revenue collection, yet almost immediately he denounced and humiliated senior management with vast knowledge and experience and dissolved the body through which SARS was being managed. All that on the basis of no more than a newspaper report, and moreover a report on events of which at least most of the chief officers could not be expected to have had any knowledge. Go to paragraph 43. Meanwhile, in October 2014, Mr. Muyani ordered the disbandment of the high-risk investigation unit and the termination of surveillance of those who were under investigation by the unit. Now, new capacity was created to continue its functions. It can be inferred from analytical evidence we have heard that there is at present a material of ongoing loss of revenue from tobacco-related taxes for want of investigation, vastly diminished regulation of the illicit economy. Paragraph 44. December 2014 was a busy month for Mr. Moyane. Following on the decision to do so in October 2014, a consulting firm called KPMG was appointed by Mr. Moyane to investigate the rogue unit allegations, particularly.
No? Recording in progress.
Now it's got to be the top of the report. So, let's go to UN chapter 6. Go down. Okay, then go back to the bookmark. All right, go down. It's PG-13, I think. PG-14. Click on PG-14. Right. Now, I want to take you to the beginning of it so that you understand what is the difference between the Nugent Commission and the Sekakane report. Go down. Go to the paragraph one on the first page. Right. So the former Minister of Finance, Mr. Gigaba, first decided the Commission of Inquiry should be established in connection with SARS, gave evidence before the Commission. Right. And he said that he had formed the view that an inquiry was required because the integrity of SARS was being questioned domestically and abroad. He concluded that a process was needed to look into the affairs of SARS, from which recommendations could emerge addressing issues of governance and integrity that were of concern to investors, the rating agencies, the international finance institutions, and the taxpaying public. Right. So they were then, the commission was then the what commonly became known as the Nugent Commission. There were terms of reference. Go down. All right. Down, down. Right. And he then provided this report. If you see it, paragraph 6. He then says there are many elements of to good governance. Principally in any organization, it is the oversight role of senior management structures that are able to put a brake on abuse of authority. But senior management was driven out or marginalized at SARS, and we have seen no evidence that senior management appointed by Mr. Moyane was anything but compliant. In a tax collection agency, oversight at every step in the tax collecting process is also vital. But the development of its sophisticated information technology, which has inbuilt checks, was summarily stopped. And the organizational structure of SARS that provided oversight was pulled apart. Dissent was stamped out by instilling distrust and fear. Accountability to other state authorities was defied. Capacity for investigating corruption was disabled. On the eve of his suspension, Mr. Moyane was about to dismantle governance over the settlement of major tax disputes. To report on each question posed by the extensive terms of reference in isolation would trivialize what had happened at SARS. I have reported instead in broader terms on what happened at SARS over the period under inquiry. Within that will be found as many answers to the questions posed by the terms of reference as we have found. But when integrity and governance has failed, as happened at SARS, it has probably manifested itself in many ways that are yet to be found. The hallmark of good governance in an institution is the existence of a culture of healthy dissent. Mr. Muyani substituted instead a culture of fear and intimidation. What is most needed and what is being looked at for employees at SARS is an end to its present debilitating uncertainty through a new commissioner with integrity and managerial capacity to restore that culture of healthy dissent. And it's against that background that this commission looked at matters. Go to paragraph 27. And there's a context that's coming to this detail, but I want to detail the interaction that Mr. Luther Lebello had with the Nugent Commission, because his affidavit is one of the his affidavit before the Nugent Commission is one of the documents that had been provided to the evidence leaders by the Public Protector's Office as being one of the documents to which regard was had. Members will recall that this issue was raised during the evidence that was being led with Mr. Mataboge. Mr. Luther Lebello, Group Executive for Employee Relations at SARS, approached the Commission on more than one occasion, and I afforded him considerable time. He asked to give evidence, and it was agreed that he could do so. He said, too, that he wanted to furnish documents to the Commission in support of his evidence, and in due course, he delivered documents in 5 lever-arch files to the offices of the Commission. It turned out that the documents had been compiled by a Mr. Mafakela. Go down. As it turned out, what Mr. Lebello wanted was a platform to ventilate what he says was wrongdoing on the part of Mr. Pillay, Mr. Rich, and Mr. Van Lochberg, which I come to presently, on the pretext of demonstrating that there were grounds for disciplinary steps that were taken against them. Mr. Lebello duly gave evidence twice at public hearings. Interspersed with that, he submitted an affidavit. The common thread through all he said before and submitted to the Commission was his wish to demonstrate that there was evidence that the persons I have mentioned were guilty of the wrongdoing he alleged. At the outset of his oral evidence, he said that by giving evidence, he would be compelled to continue to do what I hated for the last 4 years, which is to keep on saying these things I'm going to say today, which does not only hurt the integrity of the people that we are talking about, but it hurts also their families and their futures. He felt compelled to do so, he said, because the alternative was that the stigma of being a suspension hit and a purger will continue for the rest of my life. Fortunately, we were able to spare Mr. Lebello the pain of hurting those people once again and of hurting their families. It was not necessary to take up the time of the commission by reading out aloud what he contended was proof of wrongdoing on the part of the persons concerned, which is what Mr. Lebello had in mind doing. Mr. Lebello was told on more than one occasion that we accept that counsel who drafted the charge sheets against him would not have drafted charges had he not believed on the material placed before him at the time that there was a case to meet, which was the ostensible purpose of reading the documents aloud. Whether the cases brought against him would have been met is not the concern of this commission. There are forums putting people on trial, and the commission is not one of them. Moreover, clearing Mr. Lebello of the stigma of being a suspension hit and a perjurer is not the purpose of this inquiry. Mr. Lebello considers he bears such a stigma. It is best he approaches those whom he considers to have attached that stigma and clears it up with them. That notwithstanding, Mr. Lebello persisted in response to an invitation from the commission to furnish submissions on why certain findings affecting him should not be made. He forwarded to the commission an affidavit of some 135 pages, excluding its voluminous annexures, almost of all which was devoted to airing yet again what he claimed to be proof of wrongdoing on the part of Mr. Pillay, Mr. Rich, and Mr. Van Lochenberg, which he appears to have disseminated to a section of the media. He complained as well that an affidavit he had earlier submitted to the commission had not been placed on the commission's website. Certainly, his affidavits and his documents have not been placed on the website of the commission, nor will they be. The website of the Commission was established to facilitate access to evidence that is material to its findings. It is not a medium for disseminating whatever might be dumped at its door. If Mr. Lebella wants to disseminate his material, which is not confidential, he's perfectly free to do so, but the Commission will not disseminate it for him. The Commission does not accept whatever might be foisted upon it. It had invited anyone to place evidence before it and has considered everything that has been submitted, but that does not mean everything placed before it is material evidence. It accepts what is material to the inquiry, which Mr. Lebella's documents and affidavits are in large part not, as he was told so many times, and it is for the Commission, not Mr. Lebella, to determine what is material. So far as his affidavits contain relevant material, the relevant parts have been considered and taken account of, but the Commission will not be party to disseminating what is no more than malice. I might add that Mr. Lebella is not the only one who has sought to use the inquiry as a platform to advance his or her own cause. Others have also walked into the offices of the Commission with their documents or imposed them on the Commission electronically on various subjects they want disseminated to the world, and their material has been treated just the same. I need also add that earlier in the inquiry, Mr. Lochenberg, Van Lochenberg, submitted a lengthy affidavit dealing with and exonerating himself of the allegations that had been made against him. In the same way, Mr. Van Lochenberg was told the allegations are not material to the inquiry, and he quite properly did not persist. There is a related matter I ought to dispose of briefly. Mr. Lebella's documents were gathered together by Mr. Mafakela, whose firm had represented SARS in the disciplinary proceedings, apparently at a charge to SARS of about R1 million, later reduced to about 750,000. It appears from his invoice that much of his time had been taken up with attempting to link the contents of the documents to alleged transgressions of the persons concerned. In due course, Mr. Mafakela wrote to Mr. Lebella on 22 August 2018 and sent a copy to me. I am not quite sure why, purporting to prove from extracts from the documents the alleged transgressions. Mr. Mafakela also said that SARS must be given a platform to provide its version of events around 2014, particularly as to what led to the initiation of disciplinary proceedings against Mr. Pillay, including his suspension. He said his suspicion that the Commission had decided to avoid the allegation was based on the ongoing lobbying to bring Mr. Pillay back into SARS. Mr. Mafakela was also invited to furnish submissions on why certain findings should not be made concerning his instructions, particularly on what authority he purported to speak for SARS, and he too responded with an affidavit. Amongst other things, he said that the Commission is not authorized by its terms of reference to make such findings, which is not correct. Nonetheless, it appears from his affidavit that the acting commissioner had already taken the matter up, and no doubt he will also consider whether Mr. Lebella's conduct is befitting a senior employee of SARS, in which case no findings or recommendations are required. Go down. The acting commissioner rightly renounced the letter as not representing the views of SARS. We have been told that Mr. Lebella's delegated authority to dismiss employees has also been removed. We are gratified by both. It is time that dignity and decency return to SARS. Paragraphs 41. We have become acutely aware as the inquiry has progressed that the Commission has been sought to be drawn into an onslaught upon those who managed SARS before Mr. Moyani arrived, founded upon allegations once peddled by the Sunday Times to a beguiled public for a year and more about a rogue unit that was alleged to have existed within SARS, which is what Mr. Lebella's documents were all about. An inkling that that was in store appeared soon after the Commission was established, and it became increasingly apparent as the inquiry progressed. The Sunday Times withdrew its allegations and apologized some 2 years later, but meanwhile, a vast amount of taxpayers' money was splurged by SARS to trawl through documents going as far back as 11 years in search of evidence of wrongdoing. The allegations were fueled by leakages of information, and lest the public should be minded to forget, the allegations have been opportunistically repeated, even in an official SARS media release I come to later in this report. When revenue collection is compromised, the consequence of one or more of three. Government programs must be curtailed, taxes must be raised, or money must be borrowed, all of which prejudices the country. That is what this commission is about, and it will not be diverted from inquiring into what is wrong at SARS and how it can be righted by attempts to use it for other ends. If there was wrongdoing on the part of those who managed SARS before the period with which we are concerned, then the proper course is for it to be reported to the authorities. The Sunday Times did great damage to SARS and the people of South Africa, and the commission will not now pick up where it left off. And then I want to go to page 796 of the report, where it picks up the issue of the alleged rogue SARS unit again. The most senior employees of SARS are the commissioners and its chief officers who report directly to the commission. And then it points out, immediately before Mr. Muyani took office, there were Mr. Ivan Pillay, who was an acting commission. The committee will know that there was the complaint in respect of two issues. One was his pension payout before the public protector, and the other one, which is linked to the SARS report related to his qualifications. The second one was Mr. Barry Hall, the chief officer operations, and we had seen from the complaints that had been raised that he's implicated in the complaints which had not yet been investigated by the public protector by the time this report that we're dealing with has come out. Mr. Kwesi Lowe, the chief officer legal and policy, Mr. Jean Revelle, chief officer tax and customs enforcement, Ms. Elizabeth Kumalo, chief officer human relations, Mr. Bob Head, acting chief officer finance, Mr. Peter Richer, acting chief official strategy and enablement and communication. Right, go down. Then he repeats the two paragraphs that I had read to you earlier from the interim report, so go further down. Paragraph 4 is also a repeat about the meeting that Mr. Muyani has with his exco and his disbanding. Paragraph 5.2, he makes an inference at the bottom. I read you the part that all about him disbanding and asking the chief officers, and he said that the chief officers could not be expected to have knowledge, and then Judge Newton draws the conclusion. The inference is inescapable that this was the first step in neutralizing possible detractors, as foreshadowed in Bain's TM 100 Days presentation. In short, Mr. Hoare resigned, Mr. Pillay and Mr. Richer were suspended and later resigned, Mr. Revelle resigned. Why that occurred, as far as Mr. Pillay and Mr. Richer's concerned, requires explanation. Then it comes to the so-called rogue unit. The unit concerned was the successor to a unit that had been established in about 2008 to counter the illicit trades in commodities such as liquor, cigarettes, and counterfeit goods. It started in about 2007 when a proposal was considered for funding staff within the National Intelligence Agency to address organized crime and the illicit economy. Mr. Pillay was then General Manager Enforcement. Mr. Pillay and Mr. Godan, who was Commissioner of SARS, addressed a memorandum to the Minister of Finance requesting approval to fund a special capability within NIA to supply SARS and law enforcement with the necessary information to address the illicit economy. Approval was granted by the Minister, but negotiations with the NIA came to naught, and a unit within SARS was established instead. Known initially, so it seems, as Special Operations, it was then called the National Research Group, which was later disbanded, but six members were retained as the High Risk Investigation Unit. It reported to Mr. Johan van Lochrenberg, who reported in turn to Mr. Revelle. Why such a unit was considered to be unlawful is not clear to me. And that's the paragraph I read to you early on, and it's the one quoted in the affidavit and in the report. And then it goes on. Maybe I must just read it again so that we can see the context of paragraph 10. Why such a unit was considered to be unlawful is not clear to me. While the National Strategic Intelligence Act prohibits the covert gathering of certain intelligence, that applies to intelligence concerning threats to the safety of the state, which hardly applies to intelligence relevant to collecting tax. That members of the unit might at times have acted unlawfully, that SAR's employment policies might have been breached, that members might unlawfully have acquired and used equipment, all of which came later to be alleged, I see no reason why SARS was and is not entitled to establish and operate a unit to gather intelligence on the illicit trades, even covertly within limits. Indeed, that was the view expressed to SARS in late 2015, which seems not to have been made public by SARS. An opinion was furnished to the former commissioner of SARS on about 1 September 2015 in response to the findings of a panel chaired by Advocate Sikakane Essie, by Advocate Trengov, SC, and Advocate Nkumalo, who advised that SARS, one, may keep people under surveillance in the public domain, but not in private, may follow a person or vehicle in the public domain, but not in private. Go down. Probably may place an electronic tracking device on property to trace its movements. It may, however, not place an electronic tracking device on a vehicle to follow the movement of its driver because it impinges on his or her privacy. May watch a person or property such as business premises, residences, containers, etc., but only in the public domain. May take photographs or videos of people or property in the public domain, but not in private. May not listen or record private conversations unless a SARS official is a party to the conversation. May not electronically record third-party conversations by using listening devices. May record conversations between SARS officials and third parties. May accept information from informers on the basis that the identities will not be revealed. May accept information from a person, even if it knows that the information was unlawfully obtained. It may however not accept stolen property. It was said to be unlawful by a panel chaired by Advocate Sikakane, but I find nothing in his report to persuade me why that is so. Advocate Sikakane was asked if he could elaborate, but his reply took it no further than what was said in the report. The SARS advisory board, chaired by Judge Kroon, reported to the minister and issued a media statement saying the unit was unlawful, but in evidence he told the commission that that was not a conclusion reached independently by the board, but had been adopted from the Sikakane panel, and he had come to realize it was wrong. Indeed, he supported the re-establishment of capacity to investigate the illicit trades, which we recommend. Go down. The panel chaired by Advocate Sikakane SC. In early 2014, Mr. Johan van Lochenburg was engaged in what appears to have been a turbulent romantic relationship with Ms. Belinda Walter. In about May 2014, in an apparent fit of pique for a breakdown of the relationship, Ms. Walter lodged a complaint against Mr. van Lochenburg with SARS. She alleged, amongst other things, that in the course of the relationship, Mr. van Lochenburg had unlawfully disclosed taxpayer information to her. The allegation came to the knowledge of the media, which reported on it sensationally. Mr. Pelle was the acting commissioner at the time. He appointed a panel to investigate the complaint. In August 2014, the panel produced a 3-page report that was inconclusive. We will argue there's a difference in the status of the Nugent Commission report, the Nugent Commission being a commission that was appointed with subpoena powers, in other words, the exercise of a reviewable function, as opposed to a panel comprising of 3 advocates essentially rendering an advice to SARS, the former being what is reviewable and the latter not. That's why I said I'll draw the distinction between the two. So even if you had any inkling of you wanting to review the Sikakane Commission report, given the nature of the report, it's not a document that's an exercise of a public power or the performance of a public function that one can review. And so we will argue that later. You will recall many months ago, Mr. van Lochenburg had actually testified that they had sought legal advice on whether they could, in fact, review the report, and the advice provided to them was that it wasn't a reviewable report. I'm just interjecting that to put a context into why I draw the distinction between the two reports in September, and we will deal with the relevant law when we if asked to do so in final argument, in closing argument. In September 2014, Mr. Pillay appointed another panel comprising Advocate Musisi Kakani SC, Advocate Nasreen Rajapadlinder, and Advocate Patrick Romano, with terms of reference arising from the complaint against Mr. Van Lochenburg. Before its investigation was complete, the allegations in the Sunday Times were published, which it then investigated. The reason for doing so was expressed in the report as follows. The existence of the NRG was not volunteered to the panel until it was revealed in the media. The panel independently found sources that had been part of this unit since its inception, to the extent that the existence of this unit has been at the center of the complaints against Mr. Van Lochenburg. We investigated its origins. We also investigated its origins simply because our terms of reference included the investigation of any other matter that we deemed deserving of such investigation. And shortly after the panel was appointed and commenced its work, the media reports escalated and alleged the existence of a COVID unit that had been operating at SARS. By this time, we had already interviewed some SARS officials, including Mr. Van Lochenburg. It must be stated that the existence of such a unit in any form was not specifically part of the terms of reference. However, the terms of reference extend, in our view, to the consideration of the existence and operations of a COVID unit to the extent that we had not considered such issues once they become apparent, we would have failed in our obligation to fully respond to our mandate. Judge Newton just says in a report dated 5 November 2014, the panel reported, amongst other things, that at the HRIU, the high, and its predecessors had been established unlawfully, that the recruitment, funding, and practices of the units might have violated SARS's human resources policy, and that the unit should be disbanded. It had already been disbanded in October. And then he goes on and he says, I dealt in the introduction in this report with the repeated attempts in various ways to resuscitate the alleged rogue unit before this commission. I've said as well that what members of the unit might or might not have got up to is not the concern of the commission. And if unlawful acts were committed, the remedy is to report them to the authorities. The alleged rogue unit is relevant to this commission only insofar as it explains the consequences of the revelations in the Sunday Times. And then it goes on and he says, he deals with the resignation of Mr. Pillay. And he says, one of the early steps taken by Mr. Moyani, which must have been in about mid-October 2014, was to cause Ms. Kumalo, the Chief Officer of Human Relations, to obtain an opinion from SARS attorneys on the lawfulness of a payment received by Mr. Pillay from the pension fund upon taking early retirement and his subsequent reappointment under contract. In essence, in the event of early retirement, the members entitled to the benefits that accrue to him or her, less a penalty calculated according to a formula. If the member retires with full benefit that has accrued, the employer must make up the penalty to avoid an accrual shortfall in the fund. That is what occurred in his case. Mr. Makashula was the Commissioner of SARS at the time, and Mr. Goodan was the Minister of Finance. Mr. Flock Summington, a lawyer employed by SARS with particular knowledge of pension rights, expressed his opinion that the arrangement was lawful. Mr. Makashula approved and recommended the arrangement for approval of the Minister of Finance, who was Mr. Goodan, saying that a similar arrangement had been made with other employees many times. According to an affidavit deposed by Ms. Minnie Hendricks, who had been seconded to assist Mr. Goodan in his position as Minister of Finance, she brought the request to his attention and he asked for more information. Mr. Goodan raised the matter with a number of people over the next 3 months, including the chairperson of the SARS Remuneration Committee, before he granted the request. The opinion furnished by SARS attorneys on 5 November 2014 was that the arrangement was indeed lawful. Also, by what must have been about mid-October 2014, Mr. Moyani had decided to appoint a firm of forensic consultants, KPMG Services Pty Limited, to carry out investigations for SARS. The contract for the provision of its services was signed for SARS on 27 October 2014, was signed by KPMG on 29 December 2014. Also on 29 December 2014, a service request was issued by SARS specifying the scope of the investigation to be undertaken, which was to perform independent investigative tasks that was required to be focused on the conduct of Mr. Pillay, Mr. Richer, Mr. Van Lochenberg, and Mr. Picky, who were subsequently dismissed on unrelated grounds, referred to particularly but not exclusively in the report of the Sekekani panel. According to the report produced by KPMG, its investigation entailed an average of 20 to 30 professionals who together reviewed 860,000 email images from 23 computers that had been seized and considered in excess of 1.36 million documents going back as far as 2003 at a cost to the taxpayer of about 24 million, which has since been repaid to SARS. The cost to the taxpayer for the lawyers who participated in the process can be assumed to have been some millions more. We do not consider it helpful for achieving the purpose of this inquiry to delve into questions that arise concerning the preparation of that report. Meanwhile, on about 11 November 2014, Advocate Brassi SC recorded in a memorandum for SARS that he had been instructed, based on reports that had appeared in the media, that Mr. Pillay may be implicated in acts of malfeasance, and he was asked as a matter of extreme urgency to consider whether there is potentially any substance in the suspicion currently entertained, and if there is, make recommendations of a very preliminary nature on how the matter can best be investigated and ultimately brought to finality. I think it is clear that by then the Sekekani panel had not yet delivered its report to SARS. Having been furnished with a handful of documents and having a short consultation, Advocate Brassi said, in the course of the consultation that I had with my instructing attorneys, they explained that it might be necessary to suspend Mr. Pillay pending the outcome of these investigations. I can see little basis for taking so drastic a step at this juncture. If suspension is ultimately invoked, it should only be at the stage when Mr. Pillay demonstrates an obdurate refusal to cooperate, when following the requisite interviews with him and others, it appears that there is indeed a case to answer. In deciding whether to suspend, my consultant should appreciate that suspension is typically required in circumstances such as the present, only if there is some reason to suspect that evidence or witnesses will be corrupted. Before Mr. Pillay is suspended, I hasten to add, he should be told of the substance of the possible charges against him and of the reason why suspension is being contemplated. He should be invited to respond to these statements by explaining why suspension would be inappropriate in the circumstances. The report of the Sekekani panel signed on 5 November 2014 was later furnished to Mr. Moyani, who handed it to Mr. Pillay. Mr. Pillay responded to the report on 3 December 2014 with a 34-page critique taking issue with various findings of fact and law in the report. He sent the critique to Mr. Moyani and requested permission to circulate the critique among senior members of management. Mr. Moyani's response the following day was extraordinary. I acknowledge receipt of your envelope with two sets of documents. I have not read the 34-page document. I cannot approve your request to circulate the report to the chief officers. At this stage, I do not consider it appropriate that you share your views with the chief officers, as this would be construed as an attempt to influence or impose your own views on them. Disregarding the advice that Mr. Pillay could be suspended only if there was reason to suspect that evidence or witnesses would be corrupted and that he must be given the opportunity to respond to why he was being suspended, Mr. Moyani called Mr. Pillay to his office on 5 December 2014 and handed him a notice of suspension. Mr. Pillay told him that he had responded to the allegations in his 34-page critique, to which Mr. Moyani replied that he had not read the critique and did not intend reading it, as it was no more than Mr. Pillay's opinion. Mr. Pillay challenged the suspension in the Labour Court, which ordered SARS to withdraw it on 18 December 2014 on the following grounds. On the facts of this matter, as they had been presented in the papers, it appears that the applicant has not been afforded an opportunity to make representations before the decision to suspend him was made. I draw the conclusion, despite the Commissioner's affirmation, that he invited the applicant to make submissions. The following day, Mr. Pillay was invited to make submissions as to why you should not be placed on precautionary suspension pending investigations into various allegations against you and given reasons for the proposed suspension, to which he was invited to respond. I think it can be taken that this was no more than a formality. Mr. Moyani had earlier declined to read Mr. Pillay's critique, and there is no reason to think he had now changed his mind. Sapele responded on 14th January 2014. On 21 January 20, I think it should be 2015. On 21 January 2015, Mr. Muyani wrote to Mr. Pele rejecting his submissions and advising that I have decided to place you on precautionary suspension pending an ongoing investigation, including a forensic investigation conducted by KPMG into allegations of unlawful conduct within SARS in which you have been implicated. Thus, within weeks of Mr. Muyani's arrival at SARS, three things had happened. He had suspended EXCO for reasons not explicable on any rational grounds. He had asked for an opinion on the lawfulness of Mr. Pillay's pension arrangement. He had decided to employ KPMG to conduct investigations, which turned out to be concentrated on Mr. Pillay and others. A month or so later, he refused even to read Mr. Pillay's response, but yet suspended it. There is no apparent reason why Mr. Muyani would be asking for an opinion on the lawfulness of Mr. Pillay's pension arrangement when no issue had arisen around it, from which I think it can be inferred that one of the first things he did was to call for Mr. Pillay's employment file. Why would he then ask for an opinion on the lawfulness of an arrangement long in the past when no issue had arisen around it? Which employer would spend what must have been about 30 million or more to investigate an alleged transgression or transgressions on the part of four employees? An employer who genuinely wanted to know whether proper procedures had been followed in appointing staff 7 years previously might just as well have asked the employment division. If the employer wanted to know who had bought equipment, one might expect the relevant accounts department to be asked. If he or she had wanted to know what the staff had been up to, one might expect the head of the division to have been asked to investigate and report. None of that called for KPMG to be the first port of call at the cost of millions. Mr. Libero suggested that Advocate Brassi had advised on 11 November that a forensic investigation was called for, which is correct, but that was after SARS had already signed the KPMG agreement. And if an employer wanted to know what had happened in 2007, why would its investigators trawl through documents going back to 2003? And which employer acting bona fides would refuse to read the employee's explanation for his alleged conduct before suspending him? Go down. Then add the case of Mr. Richter. He too would serve and was served a notice of suspension on 5 December 2014 by Ms. Kumalo in the presence of Mr. Libello, but they were unable to furnish reasons for his suspension, as Mr. Richter recorded on the notice of suspension. And then there's an annex that's annexed and provided to Judge Nugent. Put together those facts, and in our view, the inference is inescapable that Mr. Muyani was bent from the start in getting rid of them and set about finding a basis for doing so on whatever grounds that could be found. He had, after all, been advised by Bain that he should neutralize those he thought might hamper him, and Mr. Pillay was certainly considered to be one. On 5 February 2015, notice was given of disciplinary steps against Mr. Pillay on 10 charges. 9 charges related directly or indirectly to the rogue unit. The 10th charge related to the pension arrangement. The proceedings was to take place before retired Chief Justice Nkobo. On 29 April 2015, Advocate Brassi and his two juniors addressed a memorandum to the instructing attorneys not included in the files produced by Mr. Libello, recording a consultation the previous day. Yesterday, we recommended to our client SARS that of the three sets of charges currently being pressed against Mr. Pillay, SARS Deputy Commissioner, it is not clear in which categories each of these charges have been placed. The charges concerned with the so-called rogue unit should be held in abeyance. Our advice was premised on the fact that the evidence, so far as we have been able to gather it, is far from conclusive on these charges, and that witnesses who might be called to substantiate the case were proving to be uncooperative. In response, our client, represented by Mr. Luther Libello, has instructed us that all three charges should be pressed together, and we happily submit to such instructions. Furthermore, the documentary evidence on the activities of the rogue unit is presently advised thoroughly unsatisfactory. All we really have are the dashboard reports that were made by the unit from time to time to SARS top management. Mr. Libello said in evidence that it was not he who had given the instruction, but that it emanated from discussions amongst them. But I see no reason not to accept what Advocate Brassi said in the contemporaneous memorandum. Meanwhile, Mr. Pillay had wanted to resign, and there had been discussions mediated by an intermediary of the terms upon which he could do so, but they had been inconclusive. By 6 May 2014, however, soon before the disciplinary proceedings agreement was reached, Mr. Pillay resigned. A separate and settlement agreement was signed by him and SARS, in which he agreed to resign with immediate effect. Included in the agreement was what was called the restraint of trade, in exchange for which he received payment of a sum equivalent to 18 months' salary. Mr. Peter Richel was employed by SARS from August 2003 to July 2006, and then again from July 2009 until he resigned in May 2015. He was Group Executive Strategic Planning and Risk. From July 2014 to October 2014, he was Acting Chief Officer, Strategy, Enablement and Communications. Much the same happened to him as to Mr. Pillay. The report of the Sekakani panel had made no suggestion that Mr. Richard might have been implicated in any wrongdoing. Yet on 5 December 2014, Mr. Richard was served a notice of suspension at the offices of Ms. Kamalu in the presence of Mr. Ravello, albeit that no reasons could be given for his suspension, as Mr. Richard recorded on the notice, unable to provide reasons at this time. He too approached the Labour Court, and his suspension was withdrawn, only to be imposed again in January 2015. On that occasion, allegations were put to him relating to the road unit, and he was invited to make representations, which he did, but they were rejected. Disciplinary proceedings were also commenced against him. Mr. Richard resigned at the same time as Mr. Pillay and on the same terms. Asked by the Commission to explain his designation, he said that it was in order to remain sane and to proceed with my life. The resignation of Mr. Raval. In November 2014, said Mr. Raval in evidence, he was summoned to Mr. Muyani's office. And Mr. Muyani came down on me like a ton of bricks, accusing him of being a weak leader and saying he must choose where he stood, either with Mr. Pillay or with Mr. Muyani. For a while, his relationship with Mr. Muyani appeared cordial, but in early 2015, said Mr. Raval, he realized he was on his way out when he attended a presentation where he disputed some of the material that was presented. Sometime later, he was summoned by Mr. Muyani, who said alleged criminal activity on his part was being investigated. A few days later, a criminal complaint against him was laid at the instance of Mr. Muyani. On 19 May, he was called to the office of Mr. Muyani and presented with a letter from the Hawks confirming that a criminal complaint had been laid against him, and he was told the investigation might take months and that further charges might be made. Mr. Muyani said he should expect to be suspended. The following day, he was again called to the office of Mr. Muyani, where he was presented with a letter of suspension, and he resigned. He was asked to sign a restraint in return for which he was paid 6 months remuneration. Mr. Van Lochenburg was at one time Group Executive Enforcement Investigations. The HRI unit reported to him, and he reported in turn to Mr. Revelle. I have related the circumstances in which he found himself being investigated, first by the panel chaired by Mr. Kanyili and then by the Sekakani panel, which made findings against him. I've not taken to the committee to the investigation of Mr. Kanyili, whose findings were inconclusive. Mr. Van Lochenburg was suspended on 12 November 2014. On 15 January 2015, disciplinary proceedings were commenced against him. Meanwhile, Mr. Van Lochenburg had to contend with relentless media articles humiliating him and advancing allegations to which his terms of employment prevented him from responding. By then, he was considering resigning, and he conveyed to Mr. Muyani. He was asked to present the proposal in writing, which he did. He met once again with Mr. Muyani, who insisted that he delete parts of the letter he had written, in which he had protested his innocence. He duly resigned on 4 February 2015 at the office of Mr. Muyani, receiving the equivalent of 6 months' remuneration in return for signing a restraint. Mr. Muyani insisted on a photograph being taken of the two shaking hands and smiling, and the resignation was cynically announced as amicable. I'm going to skip Mr. Hall because it doesn't fall within the context of this report. Go to paragraph 50. the evidence of what occurred at that time, both the oral evidence and that contained in many documents, of which the above is only a stark summary, has a distinct atmosphere of frenzy about the so-called rogue unit, in which even parliamentarians might have got caught up, much like the frenzy at the beast in William Golding's Lord of the Flies. Mr. Labella calls it a media narrative that Mr. Pillay, Mr. Richard, Mr. Van Lochenburg, and Mr. Revelle were driven out of SARS. He says they all resigned because they feared the disciplinary proceedings they were facing, as he wanted to prove with his files and his affidavits. Perhaps that is correct, and for present purposes, we'll assume that to be so, but it misses the point. It is clear there was an intention at the outset to drive them out of SARS. The disciplinary proceedings might ultimately have achieved that purpose. Is neither here nor there. One thing they could all be sure from the start, there was no place for them at SARS. And that was the gist of the Judge Nugent's consideration of aspects dealing with the unit and the subject matter that was before the public protector and the relevant parts. There is an extensive conclusion in the Nugent report of general recommendations, which isn't material for what this committee needs to consider. Chair, there's a hand up, I think. No? Okay. Okay.
Well, on that point, we'll take a 10-minute break, tea break. And we'll be back after 10 minutes. Just for tea break. Thank you.
Recording stopped.